Last week we talked about sensory skepticism. Does anybody remember anything about last week? You're just happy you're here. You're happy you didn't get in a car wreck. But if you can remember anything from last week, like what is sensory skepticism, go ahead and tell me. And if you need to use your notes, go ahead and check them out. What is sensory skepticism? Can you give a little synopsis of that, a definition of that? Exactly. Yes, that our senses are unreliable. They are not trustworthy to report to us accurate information about the world, the external world. Why is that? Well, this is the view sensory skepticism we talked about last week. It's not a view I hold. I'm just going over what we went last week. That's a good example of that. Yeah, that's good. It happens often. Yeah, we were talking about eyewitness testimony, how people could be possibly, logically, it's logically possible that the disciples' senses could have been deceiving themselves. And then we talked about the refutations of sensory skepticism a little bit. We also brought up the idea of empiricism. Who can give me the definition of empiricism? Starts with an E. Empiricism. We're just doing a quick review. Nothing too exciting here. We just got a couple questions. Phil, yes? Yes. And senses. So experience and senses, those, it's kind of part of the same thing, right? Because if we experience something, we have to sense something, right? Like, if I'm experiencing you out there as a physical object, I have to see you or bump into you or something. So, yes, sense experience is a good way to put it. Sense experience. How about this? What is realism? Now, this is something I didn't cover at the end, but it was there in your notes. Did you happen to read over that? Or maybe Google it or check it out online this week? What is realism? What is realism? It's at the kind of near the end of your notes. There's a definition there. It's in quotes. Does anybody want to read it? Epistemological realism. Yeah.
Sense, experience, reports true and uninterrupted, limited account of objects. It is possible to have faithful and correct knowledge of that.
That's right. So realism, if you didn't do any of your own homework, of your own research this week, is the idea that we can have an actual experience of an actual world. We can have direct experience of the actual world, and that it's possible to have knowledge of an actual world that is external to us. So it's possible to know what we call objective reality. In other words, we're not trapped behind a subjective wall. We don't have this wall. Do you remember that wall I drew between the person and the football? We don't have to be trapped behind a wall of subjectivism. We can have objective access to the world, the objective world. So that's the idea with realism. And like I mentioned last week a couple times, that I was really trying to lay the foundation for the rest of this course by going into skepticism. And you may never meet a skeptic like we talked about, like Descartes or Hume. You may never run into anybody that holds that view, either of those views. But the idea was that we were trying to learn some epistemology as we go through some of those refutations. So this week we're going to talk about something somewhat related: naturalism, materialism, and physicalism. So if you look at your notes with me, we'll start there at the top with some things you may actually have heard on the street, things that people may actually have said to you. So see if any of this resonates with you, okay? How about this? Everything that actually exists is material in nature. Okay, this is someone saying something like there's nothing else out there but that which is material or physical. Or you may have heard someone say something like this: the entire universe and human existence can be explained through entities and natural causes. So all of the universe and all of human history can all be explained through natural causes. Just natural causes. How about this? We are just biochemical creatures that evolved naturally. Have you ever heard someone say that? That's all we are. There's nothing more to us than biochemical creatures. Nothing more. Miracles are not possible as the laws of nature are fixed. You may have heard someone say that. Miracles are not possible because the laws of nature are fixed. What's the scientific proof of the scientific proof? Actually, it's a good refutation of scientism, which is next week. So you just stole the last half of my class next week. You owe me. Yeah, so don't remember what he said. Okay, no, that was very good, John. How about this? Morality, meaning, purpose, value, and free will are human projections. So all of this talk about ethics and meaning to life, and there's a purpose to our lives. These are just human projections. These are just things we do as human creatures. We just kind of make up this stuff because it helps us to survive. And nature has nothing to say about them. So if nature has nothing to say about XYZ, then XYZ must not be important or must not be something we need to talk about. Now, who knows who atheist Richard Dawkins is? Anybody heard that name before? Yeah, some of us here have heard that. So he says something like this: the universe is nothing but a collection of atoms in motion. Human beings are simply machines for what? Propagating DNA. And the propagation of DNA is a self-sustaining process. It is every living object's sole reason for living. That's all we are for. We just propagate DNA. Nothing more. How about this? Francis Crick. Who knows who Francis Crick is? He's a pretty big-time figure in the history of science. Discovered the shape of the double helix for DNA in the 60s, early 60s. You, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Every feeling you've ever had, there's nothing to that. It's just a bunch of nerves firing things around in your brain. That's it. How about this? Carl Sagan, cosmologist, he once said this in a famous, I think, PBS series in the early 80s. The cosmos is all that there is, or ever was, or ever will be. So these are pretty strong opinions, strong views, right? Who here has heard something to this effect? Yeah, maybe not from your friends, but maybe through books and things like that. So how should we understand these sorts of sayings and respond to them? Well, these sayings are rooted in philosophy. And in order to properly and appropriately respond to these sayings, we must understand these philosophies known as naturalism, materialism, and physicalism. And so these are all separate, but they're very much related. Yes, sir?
Is it rooted in philosophy, or Dawkins would say it's rooted in science? You know, the big buddy,
So Lawrence Krauss, I hear what you're saying there. William Lane Craig is the Christian apologist that debates on the cosmological argument against maybe a Lawrence Krauss type of figure. And Lawrence Krauss says, yeah, something can come from nothing because here we have the quantum fluctuations in the energy vacuum. So, yeah, you're right. It is still a philosophy, though. It's still a worldview, even though it has to do with science. And this is very important observation you're making here at the outset. And we're going to talk a little bit about scientism next week. These are kind of views that give rise to scientism. So these are kind of the predecessor views that scientism comes out of. And I don't want to define it right now, but this is you're getting at something very important here, and that actually brings up one of these other critiques of scientism. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes. In a moment. Like 30 seconds. Okay. So these philosophical systems are the most commonly held worldviews in Western culture today. So of all the things we're going to talk about, if you look at that schedule of items, we're kind of on week 4 there. It should be in the flap of your binder there. Of all of those isms that we're going to talk about, this is probably one of the most important. It's probably second to postmodernism, I would say, in that it's very widespread. So if you're a non-Christian in a Western culture today, you probably hold to some form of naturalism or materialism, or both. And, or if you don't hold to that, you hold to some sort of Eastern religion, New Age sort of everything is a God sort of thing. Or that there's some sort of being out there, but he's not Yahweh. You kind of hold to some sort of thing like that. But most atheists hold to naturalism, materialism, physicalism. So if you're going to meet an atheist who's thought 1 second about his view, he's going to call himself this. So this is extremely prevalent in the culture. So if you're a naturalist, you're also a materialist and a physicalist. If you're a materialist and a physicalist, you're also a naturalist. So these things go hand in hand, as we'll see. Quantum physicist John Polkinghorne, he says that we all start with certain metaphysical presuppositions. So John Polkinghorne is a world-renowned quantum physicist. He's actually a Christian, and he's in Britain. And he says we all start with a metaphysical presupposition. So I'll talk about metaphysics in a little bit, but the idea with the presupposition is that it's like an assumption, something we hold before we even start thinking about everything else. And so he says that we all say that matter exists without God, or God exists without matter. So all of us have a metaphysical presupposition. It's one or the other. Matter exists without God, or God exists without matter. And Nancy Piercy, who studied under Francis Schaeffer, you may remember the name from the 60s, who was a great Christian apologist of that era, Nancy Piercy studied under him, and she says that whatever we believe is the ultimate cause of the universe, matter or God, is our God. So if we think that the universe came out of physical processes or some sort of physical makeup or matter or natural processes, then that is our God. Our God is matter. Our God is energy. Our God is a natural process. If we think that the universe came from God, then that is our God. So in our case, the Christian's case, Yahweh is our God, because we believe he created space and time and everything in it. So that's very interesting to think about, and I think they're right on this. I think they're right. I think Piercy and Polkinghorne are right. John Polkinghorne. And so if you think matter started the universe, then matter is your God. And I guarantee you, no atheist is going to tell you something like this, but this is kind of a way to understand where they're coming from. This is extremely important to them. The idea is that naturalism wants to take away any possibility in a soul, that a soul exists, or that God exists. So this is the main thrust of this view. This is why someone would hold this view. They want to have a holistic worldview, and they want to get rid of God and get rid of the soul. So tonight, what we're going to do is follow a basic structure. We're going to define these views, and we're going to look at the implications of these views, and then we're going to look at the criticisms of these views, okay? So how did these worldviews develop as a philosophy? Well, you may remember something in your Greek class or your philosophy class that the Greeks were kind of the predecessors of all modern thought. And some have said that all of philosophy is just footnotes to Plato. In other words, Plato thought about everything really, really well. and everybody else just kind of thinks in his shadow. Now, these two guys were some of the earliest naturalists, and then in the modern era, we see naturalism revived with Thomas Hobbes and of course, Darwin and Huxley. And then recently, we have a whole lot of people. These lists definitely are not exhaustive, but you can see here, these are some of the prominent atheists and thinkers out there who hold to naturalism, and there's obviously a whole lot more. I just gave you a bunch of random names of some of the big shots that are out there. So what is naturalism, materialism, and physicalism? Well, let's start with naturalism. So naturalism is something like this. The universe requires no supernatural cause, but is self-existent, self-explanatory, self-operating, and self-directing. So that's kind of the first part of this definition. The second part is that the world processes are not teleological, meaning not purposeful, and they're not anthropocentric. So they're not something that we can say was made for humans. So the processes of the world's development did not have humans in mind. They were purposeless and deterministic processes. And the third part is that every aspect of human life is an ordinary natural event attributable to nature. So all of our life, everything, our feelings, our emotions, love, hates, joys, sorrows, it can all be attributed to nature. So let's go into that definition a little deeper. Let's look at the key components to the naturalist account of the world. So first, naturalists deny that the supernatural exists. They deny that miracles are possible, and they deny that humans have freedom and purpose. So naturalism includes scientific determinism. So determinism is this idea that one thing causes another, and that causes another, and that causes another. So everything in our existence could be said to have been caused by a physical cause before us. That's what scientific determinism would be, is that everything about our lives has been caused by some physical process creating effects in the here and now. So science should explain phenomena only in terms of entities and properties that fall within the category of the natural. So this is the job of science, according to naturalism. And world-renowned physicist Stephen Hawking makes the following comments along these lines. Who here knows of a guy named Stephen Hawking? Pretty well-known physicist. He says things like this. Given the state of the universe at one time, a complete set of laws fully determines both the future and the past. This would exclude the possibility of miracles or an active role for God. Okay, so right there he's saying no God, no miracles, none of that stuff. It's all causally determined. Another quote from Hawking. A scientific law is not a scientific law if it holds only when some supernatural being decides not to intervene. So that, you can't have any scientific laws if God keeps intervening and messing with stuff. So God, we got to get him out of here. Otherwise, we can't do science. Here's another one. In the case of people, since we cannot solve the equations that determine our behavior, we use the effective placebo, make-believe, wishful thinking theory that people have free will. So again, we project this idea that we have free will. It's not actual free will. It's just a projection. It's make-believe. It helps us cope. And then finally, he says things like this. There are no miracles or exceptions to the laws of nature. There are no miracles and no exceptions to the laws of nature. They cannot be broken. They cannot be suspended. It is what it is. Just accept it, Christians. There are no miracles. Now, these views are pretty strong. We can already see that. And so scientific determinism attempts to answer all of questions with nature. So all the questions that we have as humans How did we get here? What sort of things are we? Is there such a thing as objective morality? These sort of questions can be answered with natural principles, with the understanding of nature and how it works. Okay. So naturalists hail the successes of science as providing answers to problems that have plagued humanity. So they claim that superstition and appeals to mystery and religion have only muddied the waters instead of providing clear understanding of reality. So they blame allegedly anti-science Christians for being lazy and holding back humanity from achieving what we're capable of achieving. And we are just diverting attention to the supernatural instead of finding natural answers that can really solve some of the world's problems. They say that we used to do things like this, attribute mental illness to demons. They say that we used to do things like this. We used to degrade the body and the earth and women due to this prejudice, inferiority that came from a theological bias. They say that we used to, say, pray to the gods if we're, say, coming from a polytheistic culture. And we would pray that rain would come, and that would be a blessing from God, from the gods, but not lightning or thunder, because that would be a curse. Or if a tornado came and our crops are taken away, you know, that would be the curse from the gods. So this sort of superstitious thinking has caused problems for the advancement and development of humanity. These are the criticisms that they level at us. And so naturalism, however, has proved itself time and time again with science, because science has helped us achieve our ends. And eventually, science will give us the answers that we're looking for to solve all of our problems and answer all of our questions. And so the naturalists propose a grand story. They tell the grand story of all of reality. The grand story begins with Big Bang cosmology. In the beginning, there was the Big Bang. It goes on with evolutionary theory. This is how humans came about. And all of this has to do with the atomic theory of matter. Basically, again, that physics and chemistry determine all causal happenings in the universe. Particles change and merge and move around due to mechanical and material forces. There's no teleological purpose. There's no end in mind. Things just happen the way they do. One biologist said this: we are the products of a mindless and purposeless natural process which did not have us in mind. So the naturalist holds that the causal connections of entities upon entities is fixed and closed. So one entity hitting another is a fixed and closed system. There's no other non-physical phenomena that can interrupt and interject into that system. It's all just physics and chemistry. There's no free agents to go in there and move things around and change the course of history. We're all predetermined. Everything is predetermined. All of the happenings in the history of the earth can be explained by natural matter. So they talk about determinism at the physics level and determinism at the chemical level. Okay, so there basically are no free agents with naturalism. Now let's get into materialism and physicalism, and then we'll talk about take some questions here. Materialism, this is a basic definition. It's the metaphysical doctrine that nothing exists except matter. Nothing out there exists except matter. So matter or physical stuff is the only thing in existence, and nothing else exists except that which is physical. Okay, that's the idea with that first part. Another way you could say this is reality only consists of the material universe. So the reality that is studied by biology and chemistry and physics is all that is and could ever have been or ever will be. So that which biology and physics and chemistry tells us is reality. The only real and existing entities that are in the external objective world are space-time material entities. So no non-physical entities could exist. Nothing outside of time could exist. That which is not caused cannot exist. And so this materialism is a metaphysical position, whereas naturalism is an epistemological position. So with metaphysics, that's a branch of philosophy that has to do with what is real. So metaphysics is a branch of philosophy that answers the question, what is real? Or what is being? What is being? So when we're talking about objective reality, we're talking about reality outside of our conscience, something that has nothing to do with our subjective experience, but the reality itself out there, independent of us. That is objective reality. So metaphysics has to do with objective reality, whereas epistemology has to do with how do we know reality? How do we know objective reality? How do we acquire knowledge? It's the study of knowledge, if you remember that definition of epistemology. It's the theory of knowing, how we know things. So with materialism, it's a metaphysical position. It says that everything out there, that which is real, is matter and energy and causal happenings. There are no supernatural entities and there are no free agents. Naturalism is an epistemological position. How do we know objective reality? How do we know what's really out there? It's a way that we acquire knowledge about the metaphysical reality that exists. Okay? So that's kind of a way to differentiate between those things. All right, now, let's go into physicalism if you're not thoroughly confused. Hopefully this will do it. So physicalism has to do with the soul. Okay, so physicalism is not necessarily has to do with nature or God or anything. It's just really it's a view about the soul. So a physicalist says that the soul is the same entity. You can cross out the word from and put the word as. The soul is the same entity as the physical material body of a human being. That means basically that our soul is our body and our body is our soul. So when you talk about your soul, you're just talking about your body. When you're talking about your body, Christians call that a soul. That's the idea with physicalism, that humans are strictly physical entities. That's all we are. There's nothing more to us than that. So we are physical systems of chemical and physical parts. We are this way due to the natural mechanism of evolution through natural selection. Okay, so key features of the physicalist view. Okay, this is really going to make you mad. Mad in the sense that it's going to get a little tricky. So, let me take a step back before I read this. In order to understand physicalism, you have to understand the philosophy of mind. This is a branch of philosophy called the philosophy of mind, and it tries to answer the question is, do we have a mind separate from the body, or is our mind the same thing as the brain? So, and what about moral intuition? So some people say, I know that something is wrong. I know that I know that I know that this thing is wrong. So when humans say this, it sounds like they're thinking about something. And so the idea is that some philosophers of mind say that we have a mind and we have thoughts. Other philosophers of mind say that we don't have a mind and we don't have any thoughts. Okay? So now with that in mind, read this definition. A physicalist's account for the alleged problem of ethics and the alleged problem of mind by reducing the mind to brain functions and reducing ethical judgments to social customs or emotional expressions, which are natural processes that can be subjected to scientific investigation. So this is the view known as reductionism. They try to reduce certain happenings in the mind to physical processes. Okay? So to say that I am having pain is just to say, in natural terms, the brain is experiencing a sensation called pain. And we can simply just reduce the I statement, I am having pain, to the natural process of the brain's neurofiber activity. Let's put it this way. To say that something is morally wrong is reduced to the agreement or disagreement with natural cultural customs. So in the first case, I reduced my thoughts through physical processes in the brain, neurofibers reacting with each other. In the second case, when I'm talking about morality and ethics, I'm reducing my view that somebody's action or behavior is wrong. I'm reducing that to social biological customs or cultural customs. Like, everyone in America thinks that shooting the president is wrong. Well, so therefore it is wrong. It's not objectively morally wrong. And your thought about it has nothing to do with morality. It has nothing to do with ethics. It's just that you're just saying things because you've realized through your cultural network and your cultural resources and what society has been feeding you that shooting the president is wrong. It's just a cultural custom. It's not actually wrong. So the idea with reductionism is to reduce thoughts to physical phenomena and reduce moral judgments to social customs. So reductionism, just kind of remember that. With reductionism, they reduce things to a physically based system. Now, let's see how we doing on time. Okay, we'll just do this one real quick. Eliminativism has to do, goes something like this. Eliminating the correspondence between the thought, put thought there and cross out concept, and material reality. Add the word material before the reality. So with eliminativism, we're eliminating the correspondence between the thought and material reality. So this is something like, since matter is all that there is, I am just a brain. So physicalism eliminates thoughts. So to say that I'm thinking about the table right now is to say nonsense, as there are no mental states in my head. There's no thought, there's no belief, even though I'm thinking about the table. I'm not actually doing that. It's just a physical process. So thoughts are eliminated. With method, kind of. Yeah, it's skeptical of our rationality. So Hume would be a skeptic of rationalism. Yeah. So he brought about empiricism in that sense during the Enlightenment time. Yeah, he was skeptical about our thinking, our reasoning process. So thoughts are eliminated in this view. So to say that I am thinking about people trafficking is wrong. People trafficking is wrong. They would say that is a nonsense. That sort of thought is a nonsense sort of thing, as there are no good or right thoughts or evil or wrong thoughts. There are no thoughts at all. We don't have thoughts. The physicalist either reduces them or eliminates them. That's the idea. Either they don't exist or all they are is physical processes or socio-biological phenomena that we're commenting about. Okay, let's take some questions. Scientology? I'm not so sure about that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I wouldn't be able to comment on that.
In philosophy, do we have a fundamental philosophy and related philosophy?
Did you say fundamental? Whereas you have like a fundamental belief in something and then other things are derived from that?
Right. For example, you mentioned that Plato thought everything about it and that's how the thinking is called footnote.
Yeah.
I can probably explain that in terms of fundamental
belief. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, we talked about being a foundationalist a little bit. So in that sense, yes. Like once you're a foundationalist, you can build a structure of knowledge on top of that foundation. So yes. Now with the Plato comment, that's just what people have said about him just to show off that he's awesome, you know, to comment that he's an awesome thinker. But it doesn't mean that Plato was right about things, you know, so just to give you that heads up. But yes, once you have a certain foundation for knowledge, you can build other things from that. You can derive other things from that, which is what Descartes was trying to do. Yeah. Other questions on these definitions?
Well, I was supposed to be receptive to the possibility that there was another element of this that occurs within the framework of people in the exchange of apologetics with another individual, which I've encountered, and I'm just wondering if you would be receptive to the concept, possibly, of contempt prior to investigation, as opposed to any other esoteric consideration that you may have. I feel that people who are contemptuous.
Yeah.
Prior to investigation, and that is a mindset that is different from skepticism.
Yeah, well, this view we're, just to clarify, this view doesn't have to do with skepticism, necessarily. Right, okay. And then the other thing is that if someone is contemptuous, you know, you just work with that until you can get to here, you know. It's kind of like if I'm angry at the world, I can't really think about, you know, other things, you know, that are really complicated because I'm angry. And it just confuses my thoughts. Yeah, sure. I mean, these are things that we need to take into account. It's almost like pre-evangelism, pre-evangel. This is pre-evangelism. That's pre-evangelism. So you kind of have to work with those emotions before you can have that conversation. Yes, ma'am. They would say it came because we needed our social custom to be one which we think about morality in a pseudo-objective manner, where if we create a moral system that we all agree with, we can survive longer and stay away from tigers and bears and survive. And that's how we did it in our prehistoric times, and that's how we do things now. So we just carried over our moral concepts and constructs into our cultural system. Okay, continue. I like where you're going. Well, it became because we had those thoughts and the people that died didn't. So we live on because we randomly had this thought come up, and because of our genes, we're this way. And those guys that died got killed by the tigers and the bears, and they didn't have this thought of having good morals. Yeah, and this is just part of that. See, everything comes from that framework, the grand story. If you start with matter, everything is material. You start with energy, everything is energy-based. And that's where they start from. So this is a great point you're making, is that everything, how they explain our reality, including morality and social customs, it all has to do with evolutionary theory. And we're going to get into this as a critique in the second half. So you're thinking well here. Okay, now let's look at the implications of naturalism, materialism, and physicalism. So if I adopt this view, or if you adopt this view, you're effectively holding these things as well. God does not exist. There is no mind or soul. Miracles are not possible. There is no basis for objective morality. There is no meaning found outside of one's own subjectivity, and no purpose for one's life or human existence, and there is no free will. So these are the implications of these views. If you hold to naturalism, materialism, physicalism, you are effectively saying these things as well. Yes, sir. That's it. That's kind of loaded, what you're saying here. I mean, you did. Okay. No, it's good. Can you do science without holding to naturalism? Yes, you can. Is naturalism required to do science? No. Neither is scientism, which we'll learn about next week. So if I'm a Christian, is it possible for me to be a scientist? Now, say I'm not even investigating intelligent design or creationism and so forth. I can still be a scientist, you know. Okay, let me ask you this, or the class. What is a natural law? I'm not saying give me a natural law. What is it? What sort of a thing is a natural law?
Something that's constant.
Something that's constant? Irrefutable?
Can be proved?
What else? Sorry? God?
Constant?
Yeah, you can depend on it. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about something known as the uniformity of nature, or uniformitarianism. It's the idea that all of nature continues to behave in a natural way as it did in the past. We can rely that it will continue to produce things and do things just as it has always done. So if that's the case, then we could say that gravity is something that will continue to operate as it has done in the past, so that our experiences are uniform of gravity. So if our experiences are uniform when thinking about gravity, could it also be the case that if I'm in some chamber at NASA, I float? I'm in an anti-gravity chamber, or if I'm going to the moon and I'm up in space, I'm floating. What happened to gravity? My experience of gravity is—it's not there. Yeah, there's a frame of reference issue here. It's where does gravity operate? It operates everywhere, but where do we experience it? We experience it really close to bodies of large masses. So, with the uniformity of nature, we take that and we say, okay, we're gonna base our science experiment on nature being uniform. In other words, if I go test, say, the compression capacity of this cup, and I stick it in a load chamber and I push on it, this thing is not going to turn into a rabbit and run away. Why? Because I know that this thing, these sorts of things don't do that. I have a uniform experience. But it could also be the case that there's some physical force that takes it and turns it, you know, and then it crushes in a different way. The point is that depending on the conditions and the circumstances, other forces may be at play. So although we can say that nature is uniform, it may also be the case that another force can operate and interject and intervene. That doesn't mean nature is not uniform. So with free agents and God, you can have the intervention. You can have me take this away and the compression chamber just crushes there, you know. So these are the sorts of things that the scientists, the naturalist, materialist, don't take into account. They say that laws are laws, they are the way they are. Everything will behave according to this law. It can't be otherwise. But that's actually not science. That's not the principle of science. Science is based on uniformitarianism and not that nature behaves certain laws. It's that we have laws, which are really descriptions of nature's behavior, and the descriptions are not prescriptions, even though we can predict. They don't prescribe. So a law is not something that we, in our minds, force upon nature. It's how we understand nature. Well, if you're talking about like a creation model or creationism or intelligent design, some would say, oh, that's not science. Well, intelligent design theorists or creationists would say, yes, it is, and here's how this creation model can be used as a predictive set of principles. So if you talk to someone who knows what they're talking about, or you read an ID theorist who knows what they're doing, they will tell you how to set forth and do science with this creationism or ID theory behind you. So they will be able to show how it is predictive in nature. But ID theory is kind of newer, and so that's why it gets kind of bashed by the scientific community. Yes, ma'am.
This one, item number 5, no community found outside of the one.
Yeah. It's instinctive, according to the naturalist. So because it's instinctive, it has nothing to do with their choices, or there's no meaning attached to it. Meaning is just something that humans create to help us cope, you know. So that the animals, when they behave a certain way, it's instinctive. There's no meaning to it. There's no purpose. There's no teleology there. It's just instinct and matter moving other matter. So when the lion eats the zebra or whatever, it's just matter eating matter, you know, moving on matter. That's physics and chemistry at play. That's just all instinct. There's no love there. There's no meaning because she cares, because she looks at her little guys and smiles, you know, nothing like that. Yes, ma'am. Well, according to this view, they would say that your mourning is just an instinctive behavior. It's just because you have these weird attachments with the child, just like the animals do, you know. So we just mourn like animals. Right. No. Love, yeah, they have love. It's just not defined like we define it. Love is a human construct. It's a construct of society. We created this idea to help us survive. It's impersonal, yes. Right. Yeah, you touch an outlet, you're going to die, regardless of you love that outlet, you know. Okay. This is a good place to take a little break. Let's try to keep it, because I want to, this is kind of the definition, this is the issue, this is the implication. Now, when we come back, we're going to criticize it. So why don't we just take a quick 5-minute break? There's a lot of good goodies back there. I encourage you to get up, kind of move around, and meet some people. Please try to talk with some folks in here. Everybody in here doesn't know each other. Try to introduce yourself and be friendly. All right? We'll be back in 5. All right. So what are the criticisms of naturalism, materialism, and physicalism? Well, based on the definitions above, these worldviews, we can already tell, are a little limiting. And they seem to be missing something, don't they? And so one must question these systems of philosophy. We start to say, really, what's really going on here? Are we sure holding this view is a good idea? So do these criticisms I'm about to present bring down the walls of naturalism and materialism and physicalism? And just by double-checking it, is the camera turned on red still? Okay, thank you. All right, so the first thing is that the main points of naturalism and materialism cannot be proven. They cannot be proven. So the main point of these views, or the main thrust of these views, is that no supernatural entities exist whatsoever anywhere. Okay, so that's kind of the main thrust of this. This is the heart of the view. And this is what is called, in philosophy, a universal negative proposition. A universal negative, okay? So a universal negative says basically something like this. There never has existed a human being that was president of the United States named Abraham Lincoln. That's a universal negative. Or something like this. There are no aliens in the universe. Or there are no humans that live underwater in the ocean, breathing water. Okay, the idea is that you take this container, the universe, and you say there are no things called X in that container. So that's what the naturalist, materialist, physicalist tries to do. It could even be framed in a positive position like this. All entities whatsoever, anywhere, at any time, are purely material in nature. So that's kind of a positive expression of this. But this positive expression has the same implication as the negative version. The negative version, again, being that there are no supernatural entities in existence whatsoever anywhere. So the positive version and the negative version suffer the same result. And universal negatives are impossible to prove. Okay? So if you've just stated a universal negative, you should take it back. Because you can't prove a universal negative. Okay? So one would have to be everywhere at all times to check all the entities in existence in a matter that proves that they were absolute, that there was no supernatural entities in that container. One would have to be everywhere in that container or have the ability to know everything that has happened or is happening in that container to know that there are no supernatural entities in the container. Does that make sense? So, because it's impossible to prove a universal negative, and the main point of naturalism is that no supernatural entities exist anywhere at any time, naturalism is impossible to prove. So the idea here that if your view holds a universal negative as the main point of the view, because a universal negative is impossible to prove, your view is impossible to prove. So someone who holds to this position cannot prove this position to be a good position to hold. Relative? No, but see, that's not the universe. That's just his subjective interpretation of reality. In my view, there's no God. Or in my universe, there's no God. Well, that's nice, but you don't live in the real universe if there's no God in your universe, you know. So, again, subjectivism here is not helpful. Right, so he's looking out into space and he says, I don't see any God. And so it's like, okay, well, good. You're very keen, Mr. astronaut. I mean, you can see the extent of all of space, you know, and you saw all of space in eternity, you know, since the beginning of space. I think I understand what you're saying. Basically, if someone says this, it might be the case God exists, but when we look for him, we don't find him. That's different than saying that God cannot exist or God doesn't exist. Right. So this goes to the question of how can we know God exists? How can we know God exists? Because he's hidden. So this is the problem of the hiddenness of God. Okay, so that's a little bit different. It's related, but it's a little bit different than this. The hiddenness of God is something that the Christian apologist needs to respond to. But we're not doing that here. We're focusing on the statement they make that no supernatural entities exist anywhere, at any time, and never have since the foundation of the universe. That is a very particular statement about all of reality. And that's what this is responding to. It's a universal negative. Now, if you knew that no supernatural beings existed anywhere in the universe, if you had insight and knowledge to all of history and all of the cosmos, and you had an understanding of what took place in the universe, of all the planets and all the stars, and you knew the depths of every ocean or whatnot on every planet, what sort of knowledge are we talking about here? We're talking about omniscience. This is something God has. So by claiming that you know that no supernatural entities exist anywhere or have ever existed in this universe, you are claiming effectively to be God. So if you're a naturalist and you hold to this view, you're saying that you're God. You have God-like knowledge. So this is not something that the atheist wants to do or the naturalist wants to do. They want to get out of that. They want to get away from that. Okay, so this is a very problematic thing that we've demonstrated already. The second criticism here, naturalism, materialism, and physicalism cannot account for the existence of these non-material entities. Okay. So if any one of the following entities are real, naturalism is defeated. So these entities that we're going to talk about are non-material. Some call them abstract entities. You may have heard that term, abstract versus concrete, let's say. Concrete entity we'll call material in nature. An abstract entity, just for the sake of time, we'll call non-material, okay? So if any of these following things are true of reality, objective reality that is actually out there, okay, then naturalism is defeated if one of these things is true. So is there such a thing in reality known as words or language or colors or numbers or thoughts? Well, we'll get to that in a second, because how do they explain this is what you're asking. Okay, we're going to ask that. We're going to answer that. Theories. Is there such a thing as theories? Is there such a thing as propositions? Propositions just basically a sentence in my head that I'm not saying. Like, all cheetahs are fast. You know, that's the sentence in my head that I'm not saying. I'm going to call it a proposition. Are there such a thing as propositions? Yes. Is there such a thing as meaning and purpose to life expressed as an action, let's say, like this action brought purpose to my life, or expressed as a written phrase, let's say, like this statement made sense of all of my past and all of my future when I heard this person speak, let's say, or read this book. So is there such a thing as meaning and purpose to life that we encounter? Yes. Is there such a thing as logical expressions and the laws of logic? Yes. Is there such a thing as emotions and desires? Yes. What about beauty? What about outer body experiences? What about minds as separate entities from brains? Yes. What about the will? Do I have a will? Yes. Is God real? Well, this is kind of assumes the point. Again, if any of those entities that we just described are real, then naturalism is defeated. If any of these entities are real, then naturalism is defeated. What about human relationships? Just this concept of a human relationship, of brother or friend, this thing we call a relationship. Is there such a thing as a relationship? Yes. What about hope? Yes, we already said meaning and purpose. Hope. Is hope real? Do people have a thing called hope? Yes. What about the value or worth of something? Like something has intrinsic value, like a moral action, or a moral law, or a human being. Does a human being have intrinsic value? If so, naturalism is defeated. What about animals? Do animals have intrinsic value? What about the planet? Does it have intrinsic value? How about if we get pretty philosophical here? What about dimensional relations? Like, I'm in a dimensional relation to that wall. That wall's over there, I'm here. Or your feet are under the desk and your head is above the desk. Or large and small. The building's large, we're small. These dimensional relations are real. What about intentionality? Intentionality. What about ofness? Ofness and aboutness. Well, what the heck am I talking about? If I have a thought, I have a thought about something, don't I? Or a thought of something. So if my thoughts are intentional in that respect, they're of or about something, that concept of intentionality is real. So again, naturalism is defeated because naturalism says that no abstract entities exist. What about this thing called universals? We'll skip that one. We already got a little philosophical here. What about this concept of justice and injustice? Are those things real? When a murderer is put in prison for life and justice was served, there's something real to that, isn't there? Tangible. Or if someone escapes from trial, we say there's an injustice that was done. What about objective truth? What about objective morality? If any of these things are true, naturalism is defeated. What about this? These are undeniable features of human persons, consciousness. We are aware of our surroundings. If that is true, naturalism is false. What about libertarian free will? That I have the opportunity and the ability to choose and act on things. What about rationality? Am I a rational creature? What about a unified self? As my body grows, there's still unity to me. There's identity that I have through change, through time. My cells come and go, but I'm still the same person as I was 20 years ago. What about intrinsic value? Do humans have intrinsic value? Again, if any of those non-material entities are real, naturalism is defeated because naturalism cannot account for them. So what do they say? What does the naturalist say when he hears of this criticism? Well, some forms of naturalism will attempt to adopt these entities and features into their worldview. So they attempt to bring them in and say, okay, you're right. We need to account for these things. So they say that these entities can be explained by either of the following. They can reduce them to the effects of material causes, or they have to be explained as projections of our brains due to sociological or biological reasons, like we talked about before. So if they cannot reduce them to effects of material causes, like you can't reduce, let's say, objective truth to a material cause, but you can, according to them, explain objective truth in terms of sociological or biological reasons. So you can kind of ground objective truth in how we operate as a culture, as we talked about. We create this concept of objective truth, but in reality, it's just subjectivity. It's just what helps us as a culture survive and thrive in a naturalistic evolutionary world. So these are ways they try to take some of these features of our existence and reduce them to material processes or causes or sociological or biological causes. So does this strategy work? No, it doesn't. So distinguished philosopher J.P. Moreland, he says, these reductionist attempts have failed, and physicalism as a worldview cannot adequately handle the existence of these entities. So naturalism does not adequately handle and adequately account for the existence of these non-material entities. Now, how do we know he's right? Well, you have to go dig into philosophy and become a get your PhD in philosophy. So since we can't do that, you got to take my research and run with it. But it's true. It's true. They don't adequately account for these entities when you get down into it. And a lot of philosophers realize this. So since naturalism cannot adequately explain them and we cannot deny the reality of these entities, naturalism must be rejected because it doesn't account for them. So either we deny that these features exist in the actual concrete or abstract world and naturalism lives on, or we can't deny the reality of these features, so naturalism must be rejected. So if these features are real, naturalism is false, if any one of those. Much of the motivation, again, to hold to naturalism is to get God and the soul out of the picture. But if it is true that the mind or God exists, or any of these things exist, then much of the reason for holding to naturalism goes away. So, again, this is not a proof for God or the soul, but it's a criticism of their view, that if our proofs for God or the soul or any of these things, objective truth and whatnot, if those proofs hold, then naturalism is false. Now, we're going to create arguments for the existence of God. We're going to look at arguments for the existence of God later on in the class, so we're going to develop that more. But right now, we just have to say that those arguments hold, especially for the God and item there on the list. And so, again, naturalism is false because of that. Any questions on that before we move into a more difficult one? Okay. Now, physicalism cannot successfully reduce the mind to the brain or show that the mind and the brain are identical. Okay, so this is where you got to put your thinking caps on, okay? So this is a view, these two views in philosophy of mind are known as substance dualism. Substance dualism says that the mind and body are separate entities, that we're dual creatures and so to speak. We have dual natures, a physical nature and a soulish or a mental nature. Physicalist says that we are just one thing. We're just a physical being. Okay, so philosophers of mind argue, take out the word will, argue either for or against the view that the mind is the same thing as the brain. On the theist worldview, which is the substance dualist worldview, the mind possesses mental properties that the brain and the brain possesses physical properties. So the mind possesses mental properties, the brain possesses physical properties. On the naturalist worldview, which is physicalism, the brain possesses mental and physical properties. So for physicalism, they say that what we call mental are just physical. Okay, so they could say, oh yeah, we have these things we can call a mental, but they're really just physical phenomena. Okay, so if the mind exists as separate from the brain, then naturalism, materialism, and physicalism are false. So if we disprove physicalism, we disprove them all. Okay? So the brain is not identical to mind if one thing is true of mind that is not true of the brain. Okay, stick with me here. This is referred to as Leibniz's law called identity of indiscernibles. Okay, stick with me here real quick. It'll be over in just a second. If two things are identical, they share the same properties, and everything that is said of one can be said of the other. If one has a property that, say, 2 doesn't have, they are not the same thing. Or if A has a property that B doesn't have, they are not the same thing. So what do I mean by this? So let's say Chris is 7 feet tall. He weighs, say, 250 pounds, 100% muscle, 0% body fat. Okay? He's just a beast. Okay? 100% muscle, 0% body fat. And he also has these other qualities, call them XYZ, ABC. Okay? He's really nice. He's an awesome Christian, loves Jesus, you know, single, if anybody's interested. These sorts of, these are the properties of Chris, right? And let's say that another guy I meet on the street says, oh yeah, I know Chris. He's 7 feet tall. He weighs 250 pounds, 99% muscle, 1% body fat. And he has properties X, Y, Z, good Christian, really nice, and he's single. So I said, wait a minute. No, the Chris I'm talking about has 100% body fat. 0% or 100% muscle. He's really needs some muscle. 100% muscle, 0% body fat, okay? This is the Chris I know. He's a stud, okay? And the other guy says, no, this Chris I know, he's got 1% body fat. I said, okay, that is not the Chris I'm talking about. You were talking about somebody else, because what you said of this, your Chris, can't be said of my Chris. So all these things are true, but there's one thing that is not true. So I'm talking about two different people here, because not everything that is said about the first Chris can be said about the second Chris. There's one thing that's different. So if I can find one thing true of mind that is not true of brain, then I succeed in showing that these are two non-identical entities. If something is true of mind that is not true of the brain, then they are not the same thing. Did you get that? So, hold that question just for a second. So that causation, correlation, and connection, if you take note of this, between mental states and brain states does not mean identicality. So just because something is happening in my, that I say is happening in my mind, and someone could read some experiment sensor and say there's some brain activity happening, just because there's correlation between my thought or feeling and, say, their computer screen with little a graph on it showing there's brain activity, just because there's correlation does not mean that they are identical. So keep that in mind, okay? Now, naturalism must show that mental states and brain states are the same, even if they are caused, correlated, and connected. So the neuroscientist or philosopher of mind that has to that presents physicalism as a worldview has to say that everything true of mind is true of brain. So they claim identicality of mental states and brain states when the substance dualism says that they are caused, correlated, or connected, but not identical. So here are some properties that mental states have that brain states do not. So mental states have the property of being non-physical. So if you have a mental state, you have a belief or a thought of something. That's kind of a mental state, a belief or a thought. Those are non-physical realities. So a neuroscientist cannot open up the skull and see a thought up there. He sees neurological happenings that he can test and understand through with his computer screen. So a thought, then, is non-physical. A belief is non-physical. The other thing that is true of mental states that is not true of brain states is that mental states present themselves directly to the observer. Okay, what do I mean by that? My mental states present themselves directly to me privately and exclusively. That means that I have direct private, exclusive access to my mental states that you don't. This private access provides direct, informative knowledge of my thoughts in an exclusive way where no one else on the outside can know them as I know them from the first-person perspective. So I know my thoughts in a way you can't. I know my thoughts in a way a neuroscientist can't. In fact, when he reads something on his computer screen, when he hooks me up to a bunch of sensors, he's going to ask for validation of what he's seeing by asking me what I'm thinking or feeling. And I give him information that his computer can't, because I have what's called first-person perspective of my mental states that he doesn't have. So I can describe my mental states in such a way that no experiment will ever be able to describe them the way I can. So Richard Swinburne is a philosopher in Britain. He is probably one of the world's greatest philosophers of mind and other, he specializes in other things. And Richard Swinburne has been doing this for 50 years. He's been beaten up on naturalists by defeating physicalism. So he's a great philosopher of mind, and he says that the neuroscientist and the naturalist will never be able to take away the first person private access to our mental states. No experiment they can ever devise will ever take that property away, or that distinguishing feature between mental states and brain states. You will always have at least this one. But the other ones are true too. So we already talked about non-physical. They present themselves to the observer. And there's something else true of mental states that is not true of brain states. This thing called incorrigibility. This just means that mental states cannot be mistaken. So my experience, let's say, of the chair or the table tonight is a thought. This is a mental state I'm having. I'm having this experience of the table. It has this color and shade to it. It looks solid. I can't be mistaken about that mental state. I can be mistaken about the table, but I can't be mistaken about my mental state. I know my mental state is the way it is. I know the thought is the way it is because I'm having it. It is that way, but the thought can be wrong. So I can even be mistaken about the physical state of my brain. I could say, well, I'm feeling really happy right now, but I could be wrong. You know, I have this incorrigible thought. I can't be mistaken about the thoughts I'm having. Now, I could lie and report them differently, but that's a different thing. Yes. Now, this incorrigibility is not true of the brain state. That's good. This incorrigibility is not true of the brain states. It's true of the mental states. I cannot be mistaken about my mental state, okay? That's the idea with incorrigibility. The other thing is intentionality. We talked a little bit about this, ofness and aboutness. Now, when we're talking about intentionality, we say that my mental states, my thoughts and my beliefs are of something or about something. So I could say that my thought is of the grass, or my thought is of the basketball. So this kind of thing is something true of my mental states, not true of my brain states. And believe it or not, I'm having a mental state that my computer screen is off because I ran out of batteries. So that is real. So I'm going to plug this in real quick. Any questions on this one while I work on that? A difference without a distinction. What do you mean by that?
Well, your mind and your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you aware that you have a mind without?
I'm aware that I have a mind without being aware I have a brain. Yes. What else? Well, yeah, I think I'm sane. Because I think I have a mind and not a brain. Now, if someone says I don't have a mind but I have a brain, then I'm going to say, are you sane? You know? Yes, ma'am.
Mind being me as part of the
That's a good point, yes. If I have a mind, like the Bible says I have, and I can renew my mind and love God with all my mind, well, that is something not true of the brain, isn't it? The brain cannot love God with all its brain. Or it can't be renewed by the renewing of its brain. You know, if you renew a brain, you're doing something to it. You're taking parts of it out and putting other parts in. Good point. What else? What other questions here? I'm back in action, by the way.
Precision is one. So the cross correlation you talked about, if the precision is not good enough, then two things can be distinct, but they are same.
Right. So if two things are separate, and one thing is true of something is true of one that is not true of the other, then they are not identical. Yeah. Okay. So these things are true of mental states, and they are not true of physical states. Therefore, the mind has mental states that are not identical to brain states, and the mind is not identical to the brain. So that's the idea with this view, is that you just defeated physicalism because you tore down the idea that mental states are equivalent to brain states. Now, you probably never thought you'd be learning about that tonight or in this class, but this is how you defeat physicalism. And you can, if you can defeat physicalism and you have a mind that is a separate entity than your brain, then naturalism and materialism can't be true, because they say that there are no such things in the existence or in all of reality. Nothing like that exists. You cannot have anything that is not physical. Everything must be physical. This is a good question. Yes. So what happens in philosophy of mind is that the where it goes from here is that the naturalists argue, well, we have something called hardware, and the mind is something called software. The question is, how does the software emerge from the hardware? In other words, if the mind is the software, the brain is the hardware, how does the software emerge from that in a naturalistic scheme? So in other words, there's kind of an in-between view that's called emergentism, that says that the mind emerges from the brain through natural processes of evolution. And when we were pre-human hominid creatures, we had this mental mind thing kind of emerge from our natural brain. So emergentism has problems that we don't have time to get into in this class, but the significant problem is that it can't be, the mind still can't be, there's no natural way for this emergent mind to be produced through natural causes. So something must have interjected and caused the mind to emerge. Yeah, an external cause. All right, let's move into something more exciting. So most philosophers agree that there are significant problems with naturalism, materialism, and physicalism. Philosophers Davies and Collins state that most philosophers agree that reductionism has not succeeded in ethics and philosophy of mind. So a lot of philosophers recognize some of the inadequacies. Critics of naturalism point out the lack of success of naturalism to account for the human mind and ethics. So although naturalism dominates the science fields and humanities, it is still backpedaling from some of the newer challenges of theism and dualism. So some contend that it will never be able to account for the human mind, ethics, and other real non-material entities that we just saw. So again, there's recognition in the philosophical community that these views have problems. Another criticism we can say is that physicalism is self-refuting. Okay? So since reductionism fails, what about eliminativism, the other part of physicalism? Can eliminativism save physicalism? Well, no, it can't, because eliminativism basically eliminates thoughts completely. So this quote says from a philosopher, Eliminativism is still largely a minority position among naturalists, especially in the philosophy of mind, mostly because it is widely thought either to contradict what is obvious or self-refuting. So, in other words, denying beliefs and thoughts is contrary to human experience. Okay, so these are obvious things that we know about reality. We have an experience of beliefs and thoughts and reality. So believing or thinking about a view that denies believing or believing and thinking is self-refuting. Because if we don't have beliefs, then eliminativists can't believe in eliminativism. Okay? So if your view says that we don't have any thoughts, then your view eliminates itself as a view that you can even think about. So in this sense, physicalism is self-refuting. Okay? Let's do this one more and see how we are. If naturalism is true, then determinism is true, which leads to an absurd conclusion. So we talked a little bit about determinism earlier. We said that determinism is just kind of the byproduct of naturalism, that everything that happens in this world is due to physics and chemistry, just causal happenings, one thing pushing against another. So if determinism is how the way the world is, we get an absurd conclusion. So one commentator puts it this way, but this removes all sense of human intention, rational deliberation, logical inference, and authentic choice. So if determinism is true, none of those things can be true. But if there's such a thing as intention, rational deliberation, logical inference, and authentic choice, then determinism can't be true. So again, naturalism has problems. So we can say that there are no actions that can be said to be morally honorable or abhorrent, as I am just matter in motion and I can't be held responsible or accountable for my predetermined actions. So if I'm Martin Luther King Jr., you can't say that I have done good things and I have done honorable things. If I'm Jeffrey Dahmer, you can't say that I've done evil things, because I'm just matter in motion, and I just do what my matter, my brain is telling me to do. In fact, what I'm saying right now is just a bunch of nonsense, because I'm just matter in motion. The words coming out of my mouth are just noises. It's just matter in motion in my brain causing these noises to come out of my mouth. That's right. Right. We're just moving around because things are pushing us around internally. They're causing us to do things and move certain ways. That's right. You can't understand what I'm saying. And and you're like, yeah, I can't. So let's look at this last one. We're at 8:50, at least by the clock. I'm gonna share with you, let's see, there's three ways that naturalism is self-refuting. I'm just going to share with you two and ask you to look at the last one, maybe over the weekend, should you choose to accept that dare. Okay, so consider this question. If the cosmos evolved by chance with no anticipation of man, is there any good reason to trust the mind's conceptual apprehension of the cosmos? Is there any reason to trust our mind's understanding of reality? So J.P. Moreland, he uses this self-refuting criticism from his book, Scaling the Secular City. Okay? He says this, it is self-refuting to argue that one ought to choose physicalism because he should see that the evidence is good for physicalism. Physicalism cannot be offered as a rational theory because physicalism does away with the necessary preconditions for there to be such a thing as rationality. What he means is, basically, if you choose physicalism because you saw that there is good evidence for physicalism, then this is a self-refuting thing you just did. Because you cannot have rationality with physicalism. You cannot judge a good position to hold and adopt and then choose that. Because there's no such thing as a rational choice. So, if there is in fact nothing but matter and motion in this world, then naturalism is true. So this state of affairs denies the possibility of rationality, thinking, as there are no minds in the world to know that naturalism is true. And this is so because naturalism denies the preconditions for rationality. Again, the preconditions for rationality are something like this: self-awareness, to be aware of someone's thoughts, thoughts with intentionality of or about something, reasons, propositions, thoughts, evidence, logic. These sorts of things are the preconditions for rationality. So rational faculty capable of rational insight to see a result of the argument is a precondition for rationality. And other things here. So those are all preconditions for rationality. They're listed with the letters. So if one claims to know that naturalism is true, or to embrace it for good reasons, or to recommend naturalism to others due to the evidence, then this is self-refuting, because this is knowing, thinking, etc. It uses the mind. It also is self-refuting because naturalism implies determinism, and determinism rejects free will, like we just talked about. So one would be contradicting himself if he claims that he chooses to hold to determinism, because that is choosing a view that says you cannot choose. Thus, it is self-refuting to claim this rational choice to hold to naturalism, because this rationality is impossible with determinism. So knowing, thinking, choosing to believe, etc., that naturalism is true is self-defeating. In other words, you cannot choose a view that says you cannot choose. Okay? In other words, it's impossible to know and recommend this view to someone else and recommend it to yourself as a view to adopt, because it says there is no such thing as rationality. So there's no way to choose and know and judge a view based on evidence and reasons and pile up and create an argument and convince yourself that something is true, because this view says that you can't do that. Let's read John Lennox's self-refuting criticism, then we'll come to a close. This is from his book, God's Undertaker, How Science Buried God. And this is a pretty cool book he wrote. We used it last year in the scientific apologetics class. And I think he's kind of basing his stuff on some of the philosopher's stuff below that you'll read later. So Lennox refers to Charles Darwin's very intriguing statement. This is something Darwin himself said, okay? With me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. So Darwin is saying that if we have a mind that came from these lower animals, is it really a trustworthy mind? So Lennox argues, if naturalism is true, we could never know it, as the idea of it destroys rationality. So it's kind of similar to what Moreland just presented. If we developed from the material of the universe and our brains are simply material with electrochemical neural events, then how could we have thoughts, reasons, or judgments? Okay, similar idea there. So even if we have thoughts, reasons, or judgments, there could be no way of trusting them, because we know that they are just a result of an irrational physical process.
So,
and Lewis actually argues this too.
He argues that point.
Yes, he does.
So how can one man, Darwin,
yeah,
who evolutionarily came from the same genesis that he proselytizes, be the one entity of that evolution that tells the rest of us how it came to be?
Yeah.
And it was a reputation that no one was able to argue against.
Yeah. Lewis brings this up, and I think he does it in The Abolition of Man as well.
Yeah.
So this is a very good point here by Lewis, and we've kind of readapted it in these forms. So even the advocate of naturalism is just spattering off noises caused by electrochemical brain activity. So someone who holds to naturalism, when you hear him talk, he's just spattering out a bunch of noises according to his view, because his view comes from a bunch of deterministic processes, you know, from the lower animals. But nothing of meaning is actually said by the naturalist who tells you about naturalism or why your God sucks or why there is no God. according to his view. These are just noises. If something of meaning was said of the noises, there would be no way for the naturalist to even recognize the meaning of the noises that he says. Thus, according to this view, the naturalist cannot think and definitely cannot have a rational decision or discussion about coherent ideas. So according to his own view, he can't even have a rational discussion with me about stuff because he's just spattering off noises. I'm making sense, but he's just making noises. So the very assertion of the reductionist himself are nothing but blips in the neural network of his brain. The world of rational discourse dissolves into the absurd chatter of firing synapses of the mind. Quite frankly, that cannot be right, and none of us believes it to be so. This is what Lennox says. He's a mathematician and a philosopher. He's got two PhDs. There is a patent self-contradiction running through all attempts, however sophisticated they may appear, to derive rationality from irrationality. There's a self-contradiction, he says, through all attempts, however sophisticated they may appear to be, to derive rationality from irrationality. Self-contradiction. And Lennox states that all attempts at reductionism towards a naturalistic worldview seem uncannily like futile attempts to lift one by one's own bootstraps. So this is the idea with naturalism. It's the lifting of humanity by humanity's own bootstraps. And in effect, it self-refutes, because they deny the preconditions for rationality, and basically what it amounts to is them spattering off noises. So this is kind of a strong refute. And so we have to be careful not to deliver it strongly on the street. But in his book, Warrant, Alvin Plantinga, one of the foremost philosophers in the world today, by the way, these guys, Lennox, Plantinga, Moreland, C.S. Lewis, of course, Richard Swinburne, whom I've mentioned, these guys are really big shots in the philosophical world. So secular philosophers really strongly respect these guys, because they've basically refuted their positions, and these secular philosophers are backpedaling from these criticisms and are struggling to create good responses. So there's been a rise, like I've been telling you about, in Christian philosophy that's really causing secular academic world problems. So this is a really good one here, Plantinga's argument. I hope you can follow that. And then we just finish up this little lesson tonight asking the question, does naturalism, materialism, and physicalism stand up to scrutiny? And no, that's the answer based on these criticisms. So we have two alternatives, naturalism and theism, essentially, or polytheism, which we're not going to really address in this class. But in terms of the Western world or Western-based worldviews, naturalism and theism are all we have. And out of these two main alternatives, we can see that naturalism is rejected. And so what about the theistic worldview? And we'll have to present arguments for theism later that show it to be very valid. But that's for another time. But for now, we can say that this worldview ought to be rejected based on it, these criticisms. So with that, why don't we just close in prayer, because we're at our 9 o'clock deadline.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, but I'm not sure, somebody might have multiple, it might be an eclectic, just borrow a little bit from each particular philosophy. You know, it's not like he wants one, all of it, he just wants a little bit from this, a little bit from there. And talking to somebody like that would be more complex, I think.
Yeah, because... Yeah, people do that. They hold to a variety of views, like kind of component worldviews. So some will hold to a little bit of naturalism, some will hold to a little bit of skepticism, a little bit of humanism, like we'll see. So the idea is that we kind of meet the challenge of the worldview as we see it, or help them see the deficits of each worldview accordingly. So we have to give appropriate criticisms to each worldview one at a time. Those who categorize well, think well. So we need to be careful as Christians that we categorize well. We understand these views, we understand our definitions, we get a good vocabulary that helps us to define things so that when we go out to the public square, we're ready and we can filter things that are distractions, we can not follow the red herrings, and we can be very technical and skilled like a surgeon and meet the challenge as they come. So now you have some tools to handle naturalism, materialism, and physicalism. Would anybody like to close us in prayer?